Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With your host, Frank Thompson.
Hello, and welcome to episode 56 of the Commentary Track. I'm your genial host, Frank Thompson, the beast with five fingers. Actually, 10 fingers. I counted them recently, and I got the full compliment. I am also the late Frank Thompson, because it's been a long time since I posted a podcast. And this is because at Christmas time, Santa brought both my wife, Claire, and me the precious gift of the flu. And a cough resulted for some weeks after that, even after I was up and around again. And for quite a long time, my voice sounded like I was Eugene Pallette, possessed by Raymond Griffith. It was rough, I tell you. But I'm feeling all better now. The occasional cough, but by and large, up and at 'em. So I'm back, and Gable's got me. My guest today is Brian Taves of the Library of Congress, and I am delighted to have him on the show. More about him in a minute. First, I want to thank listener Ryan Fowler for hitting the donate button on the website, thecommentarytrack.com. That makes him my best friend. You want to be my best friend, too? I'm sure you do. Why wouldn't you? Come on. I'm a dream friend. So all you got to do is go to the website, thecommentarytrack.com. You'll see a donate button. It'll take you right to PayPal. You can put in $1, as people have done. And one guy gave me $5. I've gotten $8. I've gotten $10. It's all welcome. And all those people are generous listeners, and I love them all. So you can do that. Now, that being said, if you were to go in and hit the donate button and hit $50 million, that would be even better still. And for that, I would invite you over for dinner. Help us out that way if you can, if you feel led to. And if you don't want to give any money, but you do want to help the podcast along, you can do it for free just by spreading the word. Go on social media, go on Twitter, go on Facebook. Tell people that you like this podcast and tell them how they could listen to it. Go to iTunes and leave a nice review and leave a 5-star rating. That is very appreciated, and it helps build the audience, and that's what we're looking for here. So help me out if you can. And also, while you're on the website, thecommentarytrack.com, did I mention that, Earl? You can order the DVD of my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beaugest, and there are also other of my books you can order. Also, you can order books by all of my guests by going on their pages, their individual pages, and clicking through the Amazon links, and when you do that, I get a little bit of a kickback, and that's also wonderful. Doesn't happen as much as I'd like for it to happen, so any help you can offer in that respect will be greatly appreciated. And if you hit that donate button, I'll dance at your wedding. So thank you very much. Now, as I said, my guest tonight is Brian Taves. I've known Brian for a long, long time. He's not only an archivist at the Library of Congress, but a great film historian and writer. And he and I are on the same wavelength in so many ways. We have so many mutual interests. We'll talk about them all, and you'll hear us go on and on about not all of his books. I don't think we cover every single one of his books, but we do talk a lot. He's actually one of the first people I ever tried to get on the podcast, and it's taken 2 years, almost 3 years, for us to get this together. The first year, he comes out, he lives in Virginia, he works at the Library of Congress. How many times do I have to tell you people? But he comes out to California once a year to spend time with his mom in that very house where he grew up, which I think is cool. The first time he came out, we were able to get together briefly, but we couldn't set up time to do a podcast. And that was before the podcast was even starting to air yet, if air is the word I'm looking for. And the second time he was out here, we tried to set up a podcast. But it turns out he was also getting married while he was out here. While I consider that a flimsy excuse and just a way to avoid talking with me, I let him have his way, and it worked out pretty well. I met his wife this last time, and she's a wonderful and charming woman, and took a picture of the two of us, which will be on, at least probably on the Facebook pages, so check out that. So we finally got it done, And I was able to sit there in his childhood home and talk movies, and boy, it was a fun time for me. So I hope you will enjoy this talk with Brian Taves, and I'll see you on the other side. How long have you been at the Library of Congress?
Since 1990. So it's was always interested in working in a film archive, and that was always on my list of possible career choices, and it worked out quite wonderfully. Gives you a chance to work with the original materials and also to see certain ideas that pop into your head of related to projects you're working on, or frequently things that you've worked on that you see, and then you're able to identify on behalf of the library so that you realize things that might have gone unnoticed.
Yeah. How did you end up there?
I had finished my PhD in film and television studies at USC in 1988. I worked at the American Film Institute catalog, their work in the 1930s, for a couple of years, and then contract position opened up with the library and the AFI, and the next year the library was having a massive hiring because they discovered that they had a huge backlog of literally millions of items Congress appropriated for a bunch of new positions, and that's how me and a bunch of other very lucky people were swept in.
Well, was that something that you'd been aiming for? I mean, was the Library of Congress the brass ring, as it were?
Definitely. In terms of the size of an archive, I mean, you can't get any bigger. It has both more films, more paper material, advertising, scripts, and so on than any other archive literally in the world.
Yeah, I love doing work there, and I haven't been there in so long, but there was a time when I was there at least once a year doing something, starting with my Wellman book. So I guess like 1980 or 81, I went there and was screening stuff on the Steenbecks there, and still stuff that I saw there that I've never seen again. So I envy you in that. Now, when you... You were working on the Talbot Mundy stuff first, and that led to Ince?
That was part of it. I had always known about Thomas Ince and was intrigued with him, particularly since he just sort of drops out of the history books around 1915. And then I was also... Talbot Mundy, I learned, who's a fantasy adventure writer in the Kipling Haggard mode, came to work at the Ince Studio in 1923, and I couldn't figure out why Ince hired him, particularly to work on a Southern melodrama that Ince was producing, and things didn't quite seem to make sense. And then Mundy was also assigned to work with a certain Bradley King, and I couldn't find out any information. Information on Ince was scarce enough at that period, but who was this Bradley King? Except that Bradley King had a whole bunch of credits. So, obviously this was someone. Then I finally stumble across an article in Photoplay. Bradley King is Miss. And it turns out to be a pseudonym. And she was actually Thomas Ince's primary screenwriter in the 1920s. Was incredibly prolific, and after his death went on to work for various studios into the 1940s. But then she completely vanishes from Hollywood. Not even the year of her death is completely sure.
Now, was Bradley really her name, or was that a pseudonym?
That was a pseudonym. She had actually a couple of other names from a couple of marriages and so forth, but that was very much her professional name and the name she was going by.
Interesting, because there were a lot of women screenwriters at that time, so I'm curious as to why she would have felt the need to take on a man's name. Or did she just like to have various?
It may have been a few years before working for Inch. She was starting to write magazine stories, so that may have had something to do with it.
Yeah,
and she had a husband in the Navy during World War One. Maybe he didn't want using their family name in coordination with that, you know, unseemly occupation of writing.
Yeah, I think it's something that we still have to keep teaching to young film historians, how disreputable movies were in early in the century. People did not respect them at all, and so maybe that was it. Maybe that was just part of it.
Well, that was certainly Thomas Ince's first impression when he was actually wandering the streets of New York in 1910. He was finished with the seasons, stage jobs. He had wife and young son in a temporary apartment, and he was happened to meet a fellow he had known a few years before, also on stage, but who was now in a taxi, and said, "Oh, I'll take you to lunch." And this fellow was apparently literally rolling in money, and it's, "What are you doing?" "Oh, I'm in the movies now." "Oh, really? You took that leap from the stage to film?" "Sure, it's the, you know, the way to go, and you won't have to worry about that, the wife and child." And actually, Ince's brother was already in movies, so that I think that kind of cushioned
Ralph
Ince. Yes, and so I think that kind of cushioned the transition, but it was still giving up the legitimate stage and all of its glory for that rather tawdry medium.
Yeah, it's really fun to see. I mean, I guess it probably took Griffith to sort of legitimize it in a way. And although I think we're dialing back on our admiration of Griffith, there's still still people are dialing back too much. And Birth of a Nation and Intolerance were, despite whatever they did at the box office, were incredibly influential in making the film seem like an actual endeavor, an artistic endeavor, as opposed to these Nickelodeon things, you know. So, how'd you get interested in Talbot Mundy? We should start there. Mundy, you and I are kindred spirits in many ways, and I love the pulp writers, and so your book on Mundy is so fascinating to me. And of course, we have Woodhouse in common, and all these various things. And if you hadn't written about Thomas Ince, I probably would have gotten around to it sooner or later. But Mundy, you couldn't possibly have thought there was much of a commercial potential in writing about him, because he's a really obscure guy to most people.
Well, that's one of the real blessings about my job as an archivist, whereas many of my academic friends, even, they still have to find a book that's potentially influential enough or that satisfies what their department is looking for in terms of a prestige publication, even if it's not a moneymaker. I can research and write, follow my own personal instincts, and that was the case with Mundy. I had first read, there was a Classics Illustrated comic book of King of the Khyber Rifles.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where I, you know, as like so many of us when we were young, reading Classics Illustrated all the way through.
Absolutely.
And it's actually an amazingly faithful and visually striking adaptation. I happened to see the movie, which has basically almost nothing to do with the novel on television, but it was still interesting in its own way. And then what I only learned to appreciate later, Avon started publishing a series of paperbacks. So suddenly Talbot Mundy was back in print again. And later I learned that people like Philip Kaufman, who wanted to do a film of some of Talbot Mundy's stories, also discovered him at this same time. This is in the late 1960s.
Sure.
So gradually some more of his books were becoming available, but I had to keep pursuing it in the used bookstores, and some of them were getting fairly pricey, but And then eventually I pursued his stories that weren't published in book form, but only in pulp magazines, and managed to track down literally everything he wrote.
Wow.
And part of my end goal was not only the biography of Mundy, but also an anthology of various short stories of his using different settings, different characters, but that had never appeared in hardcover before, only in those magazines, Adventure, Argosy, and so forth.
The greatest magazines ever. Did you have trouble digging up biographical information on him? Because I wouldn't even know where to start on that.
It was indeed slow. I was lucky to meet his widow at one point, and also his stepson. I had good long interviews with both of them. Actually met the stepson only a few weeks before he passed away, but he is still quite vigorous at that point, and I owe a real debt of gratitude to the stepson's widow, who gave me access to letters and various memorabilia. The stepson was actually by Mundy's fourth wife, and you would think that probably, given that Mundy eventually in due course divorced his wife, but Mundy had been very close to the stepson. He was just coming up in those early 12-year-old teenage, so he had not known his own father, who had died many years before. So he had very warm memories. So it provided a lot of the personal details, and then it was simply a matter of searching in newspapers, magazines, piecing stories together. There were bits and pieces of correspondence here and there at various archives. And it was a great trail to follow, and I visited various places he had been.
Well, I admire it, because I've thought for years, of course, about doing a biography of P.C. Wren, and there's just not enough solid biographical information that I've ever been able to uncover. He wrote a little bit. There are some bios in some of his books and that sort of thing. So I would have thought that Talbot Mundy would have been a similarly hard row to hoe.
Right. That's amazing, since, you know, Wren is by far, in terms of bestsellerdom, is far outpaced Mundy.
He didn't seem to have any interest in being interviewed or telling any true details of his life. And we've uncovered some things, but for instance, you know, he always claimed he was in the Foreign Legion. He always claimed that Beaugest and all that stuff came out of that. But, of course, there's no way in the world to prove that. And we found quite a few other books that are repeated almost in verbatim in Beaugest. So I have a feeling his detail came from other books and not from reality. But
Mundy had spent a lot of time in India and Africa as a young person, and there are various accounts of his time there, and it seemed he was at least a bit of a black sheep, but according to the standards of that time, that meant that he actually talked to the native people. He may have done a little more than talk with some of the native women. But that was past the, you know, that was enough to make you a black sheep to the English authorities. But one of the things I had not found out till I was doing the Thomas Ince work is one reason he seems to have been hired at the Ince studio was Fred Niblo was shooting footage in Africa, and he and Mundy met in the 1908-1909 time frame, when Mundy was helping lead safaris and so forth, and Niblo was looking for someone to guide him around and show him various sites. Yeah. And apparently they struck up a friendship that continued and had some practical impact on Mundy's career later on, when Fred Niblo said to Ince, "You should hire this guy, try him out as a screenwriter."
Wow. What was Niblo doing in Africa? What film was that?
I think he's just shooting essentially actuality footage at this point. So this is before, It was at a very early stage in his career.
Before he was Fred Niblo,
right.
Yeah. So it was because of your interest in Mundy and that you sort of segued over into Thomas Ince, because of that, that's where the convergence was?
That kept annoying me that there was all of this, you know, as I said, that, you know, that Ince kind of fell off the radar to that remarkable career. Here was someone, you know, who was so important, and yet by the 1920s, you could find nothing about him, certainly in modern sources, and even in the most obvious contemporary sources of the time, there was still, it seemed, some kind of drop-off. And at the same time, there was clearly enough credits that he's not fading from the filmmaking firmament. So seems some conflict. And then I was particularly being at located at the Library of Congress. Mrs. Ince, bless her, had been a very far-sighted person, and upon the death of her husband, whereas the company officials were of the mindset, we don't need to keep the films now, papers. She said, I'm going to hang on. I'm going to pay for the preservation. And she did. And so most of Ince's films survived till that point in the around 1970 when AFI starts collecting for the American archives. She did try to give to archives before, and I've seen the rejection slips from certain archives I won't name.
Wow.
And actually, sadly, some of those films that they did reject, for instance, Mrs. Wallace Reed's Human Wreckage, it had become one of the lost films. But she saved almost all the films she was able to save, and the company papers, too. And so that they came to the papers came to the Library of Congress. The films were being preserved. The papers, unfortunately, became one of those backlogs that I referred to that were finally addressed in the 1990s. They were in a different division of the library than the film and television material. But they finally, after sitting for about 30 years, were processed, cataloged, made available. So once that first day they're available, I went down there and started looking up Talbot Mundy, Bradley King, to try to find out some more on these particular mysteries, and realized they had all of that kind of paperwork to begin to unravel the full story of Thomas Ince that, in a way, we've seen with the kind of Warner Brothers papers or 20th Century Fox that all of us have, you know, accustomed to working with at various points in our careers.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating story, and we'll get to the tabloid part of it later. But I am always struck by how good most of Ince's films are.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always felt that he, as a filmmaker, is a little bit of an unsung hero because the level of quality is very high, almost across the board. And what did I just recently see? The Struggle. I mean, he had that vast Inceville out in Malibu, I guess, or where Santa Monica and PCH down around
right.
there.
Mm-hmm.
And so just in terms of majestic backgrounds, he didn't have to have much going on to give you a beautiful picture. And the struggle, you know, despite whatever the plot is, you're just looking at it frame by frame, and it's just this gorgeous landscape and all. And but he really had a good sense of drama and made really exciting pictures. And so I'm not quite sure why he has never quite got the reputation that he deserves as a great filmmaker.
I was that was one of the great surprises as I was researching this and looking at some 200 surviving films, was, you know, generally what had been written about Ince stressed his background with the Western. Well, that was part of the story, but by no means even the predominant part, or to my mind, really the most important part. Yes, he did bring the 101 Miller Brothers Ranch, bring real cowboys and mm-hmm. Indians, but that was actually part of a whole realist strain in his filmmaking. For instance, when he made a Italian immigrant story, he went to the Italian enclave in San Francisco. Again, when he was thinking about some Asian-related films, he happened to see on stage Suru Aoki and her stage company, and suddenly it clicked. We could make a series of stories with Japanese settings and with real Asian actors, mm-hmm. not with white actors in makeup.
Yeah.
And so that became a whole cycle. So he was very much following a sense of realism, and particularly the last 8 years or so for, of his career, like around 1917 to the end 1924, the really key theme is the status of women in society. Of course, this is the time the suffrage movement is really coming to full fruition, and he's exploring in a whole series of films women's position in society, the women in the workplace now, women facing spousal abuse. And so this, you might say on one hand, much of the audience was female, but it not to the degree that Ince is looking at these kind of issues with a real concern of the day. And I think, as you say, that helps to give his films a real facet where they seem much more contemporary and vital to us today than some or other silent films.
Yeah. I think I first saw The Italian probably the same year that Godfather Part II came out. And so I was very primed to mm-hmm. be watching this because I was very young and hadn't seen that many silent films. But I was really struck by it, and it was probably the connection that helped it hit me deeper than it might have otherwise. But I walked out of that film thinking that, you know, that was terrific, and that, mm-hmm. you know, it's the atmosphere is so true, and the story is so understated. I mean, it's mm-hmm. so ripe for melodrama, but it never really takes it over the top like some people would have done. And so I was a convert to him real early on in my life, and always was curious about just the relative, you know. I think the manner or the made up controversy about his death has overshadowed almost everything about his life, which is a real tragedy.
Right. You know, one of the other key themes in some of those early films, besides the Westerns made out at Innsville, were Civil War stories. It was the 50th anniversary. There were still many Civil War veterans, and so stories of that conflict and of the veterans today, was a huge theme, and that, 1911, 1913 period time frame.
Yeah. Yeah, I covered the Battle of Gettysburg in my book, Lost Films. Mm-hmm. And when I was working on that, Bob Burchard brought over to my house a short called Cohen and Kelly Save the Flag. Mm-hmm. I think that's the name of it, isn't it?
I think so.
Do you remember the circumstances? Because you should tell it better, more than I should. But circumstances under which that film, that comedy was made?
Ince and Max Sennett were associated within in a corporation sense, but they're also very good personal friends. And Ince told him, "Hey, we're shooting all this battle footage and so forth. If you want to do something on the side with this, feel free, go right ahead. And Max Sennett thought a bit, and then, so he wrote a whole little comedy around the idea of this Civil War, really spectacular Civil
yeah.
War footage, that the comedy version, I believe, survives. The actual film itself, the Battle of Gettysburg,
yeah.
is lost, as you just indicated. so we have a little glimpse of what it was like, and it also is a very nice reminder of one of those unique friendships that was an important part of Ince's career at that time, and apparently they were great chums, as well as being business partners.
Cohen Saves the Flag is one of those instances. I said earlier, Cohen and Kelly Save the Flag, different series, but Cohen Saves the Flag is it's almost one of those drawbacks to the real early days of cinema, where a building catches on fire. The movie company says, get over there,
right.
quick, and film some scenes in front of this fire, just so you could take advantage of something.
Mm-hmm.
When the Méliès company was coming from New York to San Antonio in 1910, they planned to make a film around the fire drill on the boat, because they knew what day that was going to be. So they wrote a scenario in which they would enact an exciting tragedy at sea, because it would be all these people running to the lifeboats,
mm-hmm.
and all this, they would have to pay for anything. So this Cohen Saves the Flag seems to me a kind of throwback to that. And when you see it, it's really, it's so funny, because it's a Max Sennett comedy,
mm-hmm.
with a cast of thousands.
There
are these massive armies behind these baggy pants comedians doing the plot. It's so funny.
And part of the contrast of when we think of Inceville at that very early point and some of the spectacle, the surrounding background, was part of his dismay when the New York Motion Picture Company first sent him to Los Angeles in 1911. The studio they had was a very sort of small, open on a couple sides stage setting in downtown Los Angeles, and it was pretty disillusioning. But what was worst was, there as a supposed window backdrop was a bird in flight, except it was, of course, recording in a motion picture,
sure.
as a still bird in flight. And it said, no, this is not going to work, and immediately discovered they had shot a few films over in the area that became Inceville, but immediately said, we have to move our area of operations to, where we can actually show real backgrounds, not, not a stationary bird in flight.
Yeah. Do you know how he happened to light on the location for Inceville?
They had used that area a bit already, but that had not been really extensively used. He managed to persuade the company owners to spend more to expand the small acreage that they did own there. Then he managed to convince them to pay for the Miller Brothers contract, $2,000 a week for their whole winter season there. So he really gave them the idea of, we can really start making impressive, spectacular films, but that they had not really accomplished in anything but the most limited sense there. And then that Inceville just kept growing and growing, and a couple of years, 1913, I think there's 700 people working there. By 1915, there's a $20,000 payroll every week. So it really just grows tremendously, very, very quickly.
Now, let's talk about his death, because a lot of people still cling to the legend around, the Hollywood Babylon version,
mm-hmm.
of it. And even when Peter Bogdanovich made his film The Cat's Meow, he seems to buy that Hollywood Babylon version completely. So it's probably worth your telling how he did die, and then let's talk about all the other stuff.
Sure. I was really grateful to this because I initially my reaction was, well, this whole sort of construction, when you think about it, the supposed way he died of being shot, somehow Hearst was chasing Charlie Chaplin with a gun, thinking Chaplin had been flirting with Marion Davies, and somehow Ince manages to get in the way of a bullet, and Hearst can't tell the difference between burly Ince and very small Charlie, even by moonlight anybody could tell the difference.
Sure.
It doesn't really hold up by the too much thinking about it, and yet it's been repeated so much, and my publisher said, go through, disprove each of the various contentions. And so I did. Let me tell you what really happened that day. Hearst and Ince were been close friends for a long time. Actually, when we're talking about Ince's death, it's November 1924. Only a month before, the Ince's had been at San Simeon visiting Hearst, and the two had long talked about moving Hearst's film productions to Ince's studio, which by this point was in Culver City. And this would have been a very good thing for Ince, have a steady series of prestige, big-budget films being made at his studio. And he also wanted to make movies based on stories in Hearst magazine. So they were working out the business arrangements, and apparently Saturday morning Hearst comes over and says, okay, Tom, let's go out and I know it's your birthday coming up. In a couple of days, let's get everything ironed out and take a little cruise on my yacht. Unfortunately, the youngest of the Ince boys was ill, so Eleanor Ince couldn't go. And also that same evening, Ince had a preview of one of his newest pictures. And so Ince had to go through. They were still fine-tuning the editing in that picture. So almost certainly from between Saturday morning and Sunday morning when Ince leaves for San Diego to catch up with Hearst's yacht, he's not had a wink of sleep. And so then Hearst and Ince talk, iron out the details on Hearst's yacht. And unfortunately, Ince is offered salted almonds as the snack, which he's not supposed to eat because of his very bad ulcers. And nonetheless, people were, you know, eager to talk with him, wish him happy birthday, and so forth. And, you know, Ince didn't want to say, you know, I really shouldn't be drinking, I really shouldn't be eating these almonds, as one, you know, tries not to say, you know, I've got ulcers.
Yeah.
When you're negotiating a business contract, that's not in the list of things you mention.
Yes, did I mention I'm in poor health?
Yes.
Now let's move on with the negotiation. Yeah.
And then he started feeling much, much worse over the evening. He goes ashore. Many people see him to head back to Los Angeles, but he's feeling steadily worse. Checks in with a doctor and nurse, and they say, you know, your stomach is in really bad way. And the saying had always been about Ince, he had a $1 million mind and a 10-cent stomach.
Mm.
And things were getting worse. Eleanor came down in a special train with their eldest son, who in his own maturity would become a physician. They took him home, and a few days later, Ince had succumbed from a heart attack induced by the ulcers. And he had long been suffering from angina problems. And the unfortunate part was, of course, Hearst had many enemies. And when you work with someone who has some enemies, sometimes you inherit them too. And as well, the very year before, Ince had made a movie about yellow journalism, and this is long before the genre of movies about reporters and fast talking and digging up the scoops and so forth had become a known, accepted type of film lore. A lot of reporters really objected to this movie, which was in fact that same one that Talbot Mundy had worked on, Her Reputation. So there were a number of reporters who probably seemed to have had the notion, well, you know, we don't like Hearst. We really don't have any use for Ince either. And we'll, you know, suggest that there might have been problems here. In fact, the whispers are totally demonstrably false. For instance, they say Luella Parsons was on the boat. She was in New York at the time. And so things start to really fall apart. Hearst and Charlie Chaplin, whom he was supposedly chasing for flirting with Marion Davies, Hearst and Chaplin remained friends for another 15 years till politics drove them in different directions. Mm-hmm. So it really doesn't add up. As you mentioned, in what's really sad, I think, is that Peter Bogdanovich, because of his reputation as a Hollywood historian, you know, lent his own credibility to that film, The Cat's Meow, that essentially brings this to life. And usually when you see a movie with real characters, real dates, where the names are there, you expect some, at least maybe a little fiction, but overall that it's fact. At least Citizen Kane went to the trouble of changing some names.
Sure.
So you see, that's a little bit different, but The Cat's Meow didn't. So a lot of people assume that it's got to be at least a good share true, and you know, if you go on Wikipedia, you'll find somebody's put in a whole long entry about Ince's death, essentially drawn straight from The Cat's Meow.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of people have just always looked at that like, oh, where there's smoke, there's fire. If you keep mm-hmm. hearing these stories, there's got to be something to them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's really weird. And what I always, and I guess I first started finding out about the truer story maybe 20 years ago. I think Bob Burchard was mm-hmm. one. I had a talk with him, and he had interviewed Ince's wife at some point, and she was just perplexed mm-hmm. as to why this was even a thing. And what's so strange about it is, as you say, he wasn't even on the yacht. He died days after right. leaving the yacht.
It was investigated.
It's not even like they carted his right. body off, you know.
Right.
And it's just so strange.
Hearst, of course, did have opposition newspapers, such as the Los Angeles Times at the time, at that point, who did look into all the circumstances and found nothing of suspicion. It certainly had. The anti-Hearst press found even something remotely to really hang on to. They would have, followed it up, but they found nothing. The police checked Ince's body before the funeral. What does seem to get some people suspicious is the idea of, well, Ince was cremated. Maybe they were covering up something. Well, one of the absolutely fascinating surprises I discovered was Ince and his wife were theosophists. And theosophy looks to Eastern religions for ideas about living. And so in terms, for instance, Buddhism and so on. And so cremation, which was then a little less common than today, was something, was part of the theosophical teaching. And that was not, that was something that INSAs had already planned for each other, that, that would be their own particular way. And, you know, we also, before that happened, the, many of the Hollywood greats who worked, with INS, Mary Pickford, for instance, came by and saw the hat casket. Nobody saw a bullet hole in INS. So, there's just really not the slightest bit of evidence to back this up. And, you know, what's really sad in a way, I think, is not only this story, this myth, but what I was really most disillusioned in terms of Bogdanovich, the cat's meow. It not only perpetuates this myth, but for whatever reason, and this part Bogdanovich must have known was not true, he completely belittles the INS-Hearst relationship, makes INS a supplicant to Hearst, and he has INS completely washed up, where at one point in the film he says he's lucky to make a film a year. In fact, that year he died, INS had already released 15 films. At the time he died, 9 movies were before the camera. The notion that, you know, INS was not an active filmmaker, just wholly preposterous.
Yeah. It's, I've always admired Peter Bogdanovich, and so, and as a film historian, I've always thought he was one of the first real, one of the first to really ask real questions of filmmakers. And so I think of him as one of the pioneers in what we eventually came to be doing. And I was so flummoxed by that film. I just couldn't figure out why in the world somebody like him would do it. You know, if John Waters had done it, that's one thing. You know, and I probably would have been funnier. But I just, it's so weird. So weird. And even, as you say, even if he had made that story and changed the names so that it would be kind of based on this folklorist thing, that would be one thing. But it's presented as total fact. So, just very strange.
And as you say, it's the, you know, the really sad thing is it has so overshadowed the rest of INS's career, and people don't know, you know, the films he made, or and actually, I mean, some of this goes back a while. For instance, in that pioneering book in 1939, The Rise of the American Film, Louis Jacobs throws away INS's career past 1915, saying something, well, his company, Triangle, went broke. Well, it wasn't INS's company. And then he died mysteriously. Well, there's a 9-year gap between that.
And a lot of movies.
Right.
A lot of movies. And, yeah, so strange. It's almost like it almost makes you believe in the concept of alternate universes, because these things get so entrenched that you think, well, maybe that is a true story somewhere. it's just so strange.
And right. I had a film historian, and we were corresponding, and, you know, talked about that exact issue. And he said, "Yeah, I think the movie must be, you know, basically untrue, but there may probably." Some smoke to the fire. Like, here's someone who I won't name, but who is a very distinguished historian. And it was like, no, you can't think that when you think about it.
It always disappoints me when I hear people that I otherwise would think know film history, and they get to that story, and they just, I mean, there are lots of stories like that through Hollywood history that people just take the, you know, as they say in Liberty Valance, they print the legend. And so it's, I guess we shouldn't be that surprised by it, but.
And as you mentioned, Mrs. INS kept wondering all these years, how can I lay this to rest? What more can we do? And I found, you know, actually sort of buried in various magazines, a number of places where it had been more set to rest, but not in sources people generally look to. So she, you know, it was a very disillusioning matter for her. And initially I was a bit reluctant to approach the Ince family because I thought, well, they might think I'm, you know, writing an exploitive biography. And so I was well along in the work, and then I finally decided I've really got to do this, and got to know particularly Nancy Ince Probert, who is the Ince granddaughter by his middle son, and she lives in Northern California. She lived for a long time with Eleanor Ince, Thomas Ince's widow, so she was able to give me a particularly rich variety of personal details right. about Eleanor's long career after her husband's death. She lived more than 45 years. And really treasured his memory through that time. So it was, and yet, she'd keep hearing this, and she had her own share of tragedy because their youngest son was killed in 1937 in a motorcycle accident after promising his mother he would stop such activities. So she felt, well, I'm a bit bad luck here. Two sons fortunately lived to maturity, but she had more than her share of misfortune.
Wow, that's sad. But I think this whole story is indicative of something that we're seeing more and more of, it seems to me, as time goes on, and that is that people want to believe the worst about things. Mm-hmm. And if there's a scandalous story, such as that William Randolph Hearst shot Thomas Ince, and then you say, no, it didn't happen, anything like that, many people just respond with, oh, yeah, that's what they want you to think. Mm-hmm. You know, they cooked up this whole story so that Hearst wouldn't... He was a newspaper man. He could make up any story he wanted to. So,
well, at that point, his power is definitely waning. So his ability to arrange a cover up is definitely minimal. And as well, Mrs. Ince, they had extensive real estate holdings in Los Angeles beyond the studio, which she was able to sell for $1 million. She had been very actively involved in the company from its early stages. She helped write scenarios for her husband. She helped scout locations for him. She was part of the corporate structure. So while raising three boys, she was also a real confidant to her husband. And to think, she and Hearst remained friends afterward, but to think that she would have, when she had plenty of money, remained friends with someone who had shot her husband,
sure.
deprived her three boys, ranged from 7 to 15 years of age at that point, of their father, is a level of absurdity.
Unless she was in on it. I guess you never thought about that.
That was the part I thought, of all the parts about the cat's meow, I found most vexing, even more than belittling Ince's career, was she was made out to be naive, hopeless, the sort of, quote, just a housewife syndrome, who hadn't any idea what her husband was doing. And I thought, okay, of all the things, even if you didn't want to do the research, there's no reason to so wholly denigrate her as a character in a story like that. And especially once I found out the real Eleanor Ince and just how important a contribution she was to his career and really his strong right hand all of those years that helped him to be such a prolific filmmaker. Often we look and say, Ince really made 800 films? Well, you have to remember two things. A lot of those are short films. But also, he had someone beside him who was never taking credit, but who was researching, giving bits and pieces of ideas and so forth. And that was Eleanor Ince.
Yeah.
So often when you see his name, particularly in the early films, those are Eleanor's ideas in there.
But yeah, you do have to admit that 800 films is one film a year. So at least they were right about that in the movie. Let's switch gears a little bit, because obviously we share a real interest in Robert Flory. Now, you knew Flory, right?
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
My mom and Virginia Flory had met at UCLA around 1950, and so they had become very good friends at that point, and remained so, actually, until the end of Virginia Flory's life. My mom was probably her only surviving friend at that point. So many people from the studio had already passed on, the people Virginia had worked with, and she was had been a Busby Berkeley dancer and a sport supporting actress in a variety of films in the 1930s. And there's a picture of the Florys at my parents' wedding a few years later into the 1950s. And then when I was about seven or so, my mom took me up to meet them. And I was already entranced with history, just history generally, at that point. And Florys, he was never one of those people who, you know, say, like Frank Capra would, you know, tell you all about his career, all about the films he had made. Flory was very quiet on that score, but he was had a phenomenal collection on French history, Napoleona, the French Revolution, and you can imagine, well, we'd go up every few months, and he'd give me some sword or something from the French Revolution. I tried on a jacket that had belonged to Napoleon.
Wow.
And so I was entranced, and of course this gave me my added to my interest in history. We talked a bit about films, though he was not, you know, I wanted to find out more about his films. Remember, this is around 1970. It's hard to find credits in a way that today's generation doesn't understand. And I did manage to catch a couple of his films. But usually we talk about history. He gave me some Jules Verne first editions that helped foster a hobby that's gone on to include quite a number of publications today. So he helped me in that respect. And then at USC, I discovered film studies, and I began to ask more questions, hopefully a little more, showing a little more background, and he was opening up more and more. And he passed away when I was 20 in 1979. But the friendship with Virginia Flory continued over all of those years, and I organized all of his papers, and she gave me access to everything. So I was able to, he had kept incredible scrapbooks and tens of thousands of stills, all at the Academy now. And so I organized all of that material, and that really gave me a vast amount of primary information on his career, which I was then able to filter through the background of knowing him and knowing his personality. And he was a little bit of a perfectionist. For instance, I remember telling him, oh, they're showing The Beast with Five Fingers over here at this revival house. And he was like, oh, don't see. It's not really the way I wanted it to come out. I wanted it more subjective and more to see it through the main character's mind. So, unlike a lot of directors, he was very, very reticent about promoting himself. And he was also a little, you know, he was born in France, and he felt, well, I've got, you know, I've still got an accent. You know, no one would have paid attention to that. But, well, I want to make sure I've got everything right. Plus, he was writing books on Hollywood history, generally. So he would always, well, people can go there and see my reminiscences.
And, of course, he was also interested in the Foreign Legion.
So, yes.
That
was part of that whole collection of French memorabilia and uniforms, hats, medals, buttons. It was incredible. After his death, it formed its own unique sale with Sotheby's and Monte Carlo. There was just so much material.
Yeah. So all of his non-film related material was just auctioned off? There's no collection of it anywhere?
The French collection that was the various books he had, the film books gone to film archives, the other books on just generally French history and so forth have gone to a variety of libraries, universities, and so forth.
Yeah. Now, he was slated to direct Frankenstein, and so it's obviously something that he probably thought of a lot over his life, is how that would have changed the course of his career, because I think he was always a well appreciated filmmaker, but I don't know that he was ever top-tier star filmmaker. I mean, he was never a Ford or a Hawks or Capra or Hitchcock, anything like that. But had he made Frankenstein, I wonder if that would have sent his career in a slightly different direction.
That's what he always wondered. One of the pleasures of, you know, writing the book about him is, which was finished in 1987 and published by Scarecrow at the time, it's going to be reprinted by Bear Manor next year, is that since I did it, so many more of his films are readily available, TCM, DVD, and so forth. It was very hard to see that many of his films at that time outside of archives, and now it's much, seeing the Robert Flory oeuvre is not such a challenge. And so that's been something really, really, when you've written about someone, as you know with William Wellman, when the films start to show, that makes you feel like, well, some of my task is completed. And the Frankenstein situation was, he had just come back from making films in France, some of the first French talkies. So it was his first job back in the U.S., though he had already spent 1921 to 1929 in the United States, including some of the first talking films at the Paramount Astoria studio. So he was back with a contract with Universal, which seemed to say he would be writing and directing. So they were looking for a follow-up to Dracula, and the studio came up, well, let's try Frankenstein. Give us your ideas on that. And Flory explained to them, while he noted Junior Lemley was giving his fingernails to the manicurist and interrupting with phone calls, and would look at, wait a minute, what monster are we talking about? What's this? So it was a bit hectic, but he went back and wrote, with the help of Garrett Fort, writing dialogue, the first draft of the Frankenstein script, and everything seemed to be going forward. They wanted Bela Lugosi to star, as he had been Dracula. Lugosi imagined himself as the scientist, not the monster. That was the big problem. So you had a star that was not, potential star that was not happy. But they had Flory go ahead, film several days of the test of the monster coming to life, and apparently everything was going well, and somehow James Whale, who had a much more prestigious position at the studio, got a hold of the Frankenstein script and thought, ah, this looks like an enjoyable task. And you know, quite simply, he had a stronger position with the management than Flory did. Flory, as I say, was just back from France. And meanwhile, Bela Lugosi is complaining. So they said, here, Flory, you work on Murders in the Rue Morgue. And he said, wait a minute, I thought I'm supposed to write and direct a movie. Yeah, this will be the movie you write and direct. So he was annoyed about that. And now his original script that he left behind does survive. The difference was his draft was much more... much darker, much more bloodthirsty monster. That part of the legend is true. There are other details that have been written that are simply not true. The makeup was essentially the same. Though of course Lugosi and Boris Karloff, do have some different, general appearance, but of course we did eventually see Lugosi play the monster in due course. And then the other irony was that when Karloff was cast, he and Flory had been friends for many years back to a movie called Parisian Nights, some years before with René Adore. Mm-hmm. And so here's apparently Karloff says, Bob, my old friend, we're back on the same lot. And Boris, is that you with all that makeup? And so years later, again at Universal Television and the Boris Karloff's Thriller series, they make a TV show, The Incredible Dr. Marcus.
Sure.
Said.
Well.
Yeah, and so that was their opportunity to finally get back together as star and director, and has monsters very much akin to the conceptions of those earlier days.
You know, you remind me when Lugosi didn't want to play the monster. I was just thinking this the other day. Were there any actors who made worse choices in their lives than George Raft and Bela Lugosi? Both of them turned down these incredible things and ended up doing this. You know, their careers just spiraled out of control because they simply couldn't see what was good for them. And it's really weird to watch. Mm-hmm. And you think of how many things were offered to George Raft that he just, no, that's not for me. It's no good. Casablanca? No. Flory, for his incredible interest in history, and didn't make a lot of historical films. I mean, he did make three that deal with the Foreign Legion, which I'm gratified about. I've still never seen his version of Desert Song, which I hope to find a good Technicolor print to see one of these days. Although they didn't shoot it on sand dunes, which annoys me, but I'm sure he had his own color ideas. Mm-hmm. But it was... I wonder how much control he ever had in his life for choosing projects and going forward with them.
That was one of the real frustrations. He writes that I never really had the choice of saying, I want to do this. I think he did have a certain level of, no, I really don't want to do that at some points. But for instance, The Beast with Five Fingers, he was at that point in 1946, he had just come off directing God Is My Co-Pilot, which was a huge box office hit. The Desert Song, again, a box office hit. I don't want to go back to directing a story of a disembodied hand running around killing people. And I said, okay, you're going on suspension. See you in 3 months. And he came back in 3 months. Here's the beast with five fingers. In some cases, though, he was able to guide things a little bit more, but certainly he wasn't in that class of directors who was able to say, you know, I will do this, I will do that. He remarkably did say, in the, particularly the early days of television, he had established a good friendship with Dick Powell and Charles Boyer in the days of four-star theater and some of the other early dramatic anthologies, that he had a lot more freedom there to place the camera where he wanted, to, you know, do, handle the lighting, to choose the supporting players. Whereas, for instance, there's a quite wonderful memo from Hal Wallace in the for the 1934 film Smarty with Joan Blondell, where it tells Florey, stop using all those close-ups. We don't want all these close-ups. We want medium shots. Stick to medium shots. So often, or even in what seemed to be the smallest our details, there was that kind of studio interference or studio problematic. I think Paramount, he does seem to have been done, had more, found, you know, management that was a little more in tune with his own European sensibility, and particularly the several films with Anna May Wong are some of the most striking in terms of overlapping personalities that really fuse to make some remarkable films.
I do detect a directorial personality whenever I see one of his films. Mm-hmm. And so even though he's just getting assignments, and sometimes assignments he doesn't want, mm-hmm. he's still an artist, and you can still see it in what he does. Did you, it's so hard, and my point of view is vacillating all the time on this, on what a director does and how a director influences. You know, I used to think it was all, when I would see great camera work and great editing, I would say, oh, that's great directing. And then one day it occurred to me, no, that's photography and editing. That's not mm-hmm. directing. But did you ever, I mean, you've seen most of Florey's films and studied them. Do you see that in, as well? I mean, did you see a Florey touch to his work?
Yes, I gave the book the subtitle The French Expressionist, because I did see that he was, particularly in the earlier years, the tenets of what we usually call German Expressionism were strongly influential on his films. Though later, by the late 30s and then into the 40s, he has a much stronger realist strain surfacing in his work. But it does have, I think, you know, a very definite personality. There are clear choices being made, even when a film doesn't seem to be particularly his cup of tea. But when it is, then you do see that something very unique, particularly when he has a sort of mysterious or thriller suspense type project. That's certainly where his own personality comes to the fore. But also, you know, as you mentioned, his Foreign Legion films, projects not so often discussed, Outpost in Morocco, with George Raft, as something, I mean, that would be as close as to something he really wanted to do, yeah. Or The Desert Song, which sadly, has never, it's a Warner Brothers film, but has never appeared on TCM because apparently of some rights situation with a single song. And of course, they remade it a few years later, so they keep showing the remake.
Sure. And the 29 was even easier to see.
Yeah. So it's, why particularly, and it's a beautiful beautiful film. The photographically, as you mentioned, being shooting out in the desert around Gallup, New Mexico, in full blazing Technicolor, and brings together the idea of the French collaborating with the Nazis in a way and that's, you know, would not appear in other versions of the Desert Song.
Sure.
So you really get a much stronger side of the Arabs fighting for their own freedom that probably wouldn't be made today if the movie was being remade. But it, at that point was during the midst of World War II. Gave it a real unique cachet.
Yeah, because he really hit World War II head on in the, mm-hmm. I mean, so I read, as mm-hmm. I say, I've never been able to see it, but mm-hmm. I will someday. Did you ever formally interview him?
In the last couple of years, we were talking more, more formally. I was usually, still I was young enough, more to be followed by where he was going. The one sad thing, he did not want to be tape recorded.
Hmm.
And I think because he, you know, as I say, was a little bit of a perfectionist, and because if someone's going to write this out and my English, I'm going to mess up a few words here and there or something. And it doesn't seem that he was ever actually taped. I think, in fact, I'm almost sure had, you know, he lived a few more years, the fact that the closeness I had already, he would have finally broken down that barrier because he was telling me more and more and, you know, bringing out more and more of the stills of his productions. And, well, let me tell you about Daughter of Shanghai and here's Anime Wong and who's this? That's Virginia Flory? Yes, they're dancing together. And so he was really opening up in so many ways. And one of the last films I saw just before his death was The Beast with Five Fingers, which I do consider one of the masterpieces, as well as The Face Behind the Mask. And yeah. I was going to sit down and discuss those with him in detail. Alas, that wasn't to be.
It's a shame he had such a negative opinion of Beast with Five Fingers, because it's great.
Mm-hmm.
It really is great. So, Kevin Brownlow wanted to interview him for the Hollywood series, and that just timed out wrong, right?
It was that same situation where he was really reluctant as well. The last few years, he had retired from television directing because of health problems, and he'd be okay for a while, and then things would get a bit worse. So you had to, you know, go at the right point to catch him when things were, you know, well health wise. So that was an issue when Brownlow wanted to do that, and you know, he said wanted. I know I saw some of the letters. Please, Mr. Flory, I really want to do an extensive interview with you because you were there in so much of Hollywood history. And
Kevin knew what a good Hollywood historian he was, too, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. It's really a shame that he didn't have that in-depth interview that mm-hmm. he really should have. Too bad.
Yeah, I look at, for instance, interviews with Henry King, and I think, if only we could have something like that. If only Flory had that same kind of readiness, open, you know. But Henry King did live quite a number of years longer, so went to so many different venues. Flory died at 78, versus Henry King, I think, 96.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it is a shame. We should probably wrap it up, but before we do, we need to talk about my favorite author. And this is literally a book that I would have written had you not written it. You just got to it first, but I definitely would have done this one on Woodhouse in film, P.G. Woodhouse. And the irony with P.G. Woodhouse is, as I say, he's my favorite author. There's nobody even in the running for the number one spot. But he writes a kind of prose that is impossible to translate to film.
Mm-hmm.
And so the film history of P.G. Woodhouse is a lot of really spotty work. And sometimes it works okay, and sometimes it's awful. And when I say awful, I mean Arthur Treacher. Mm-hmm. And those films are just unspeakable. And then good, the Jeeves and Wooster series on that came over from England with Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry. And those hit a certain close proximity to Woodhouse, but even so. The example I always give is a line in one of the Jeeves novels when Bertie says, "The dog looked at me as if I were more to be pitied than censured." And this is a spectacularly wonderful line, but there's no way to film that. There's absolutely no, it can't be done. So, what did you find when you started looking through, and you went, there's silent adaptations of his films. They always had to go to plot, and they could never really go with the authorial voice, right?
Yes, quite amazingly, there's probably more silent movies of Woodhouse in that particular limited period of less than 15 years. The first film was in 1915 and actually survives. Apparently, and a number of them are stage shows, even stage musicals.
Yeah.
And you would think this would not work. But from the surviving examples, it seems to have that in many cases they were sticking fairly close to the story, certainly more than Arthur Treacher as Jeeves. And then as sound comes in, Woodhouse is asked by MGM to come help with writing dialogue for films. But they apparently don't really have an idea what they want him to do. They just say, "Here, try this script, see if you can brush it up," or anything. Or, "Can you write a novelization of Rosalie? We think we're going to produce it." And then a few months later, "Yeah, we decided not to produce it." So Woodhouse, having worked on stage, as well as his writing short stories and novels, he has that stage collaborating background. So he's looking at this and thinking, okay, usually I sit down with, you know, one or two or three guys and we work it out. Well, this is not what's happening in Hollywood. And he ends up very frustrated after a year, and he's being very well paid. And he says, "You know, sorry I didn't really produce anything for all that hundred and some thousand," which he unfortunately says to a newspaper correspondent who publishes it, and there's contretemps in Hollywood. What are we paying this guy for? Which lasts all of maybe a couple of weeks. And then, you know, Hollywood's forgotten it by that point, adapting his work again. But he does eventually come back to Hollywood and does have that really unique opportunity for an author of working on an adaptation of one of his novels, A Damsel in Distress.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably, that does give him a status of, you know, a certain success in Hollywood that even considering the variable quality of the other adaptations or other pictures to which he contributed some lines or dialogue here and there. But the movie of A Damsel in Distress, can say, is pretty much Woodhouse, because he's having, you know, he's really the primary screenwriter there.
Yeah. He spoke very poorly of that film, and yet I contend that it has probably the purest Woodhouse spirit of any movie.
Mm-hmm.
It has its faults, and it has some major faults, but in terms of being set in a Woodhouse setting, having, you know, the lord of the manor and the, his young jazz-loving son and the all the intrigue downstairs or
mm-hmm. Reginald Gardner
yeah.
as the butler and
one of the Watson kids mm-hmm. doing the worst right. British accent that mm-hmm. anyone's ever done
mm-hmm.
and I'm including Dick Van Dyke and Mary Poppins in this but it still has a real feeling and the what really kills it of course is Joan Fontaine who had no business being mm-hmm. partnered with Fred Astaire. And one of the funniest things in the film is unintentionally funny is when they're doing that mm-hmm. Long walk right. along the riverside, and they keep putting her behind
right.
trees
yeah.
to disguise the fact that she just can't dance a step, not a step.
Mm-hmm.
But he spoke of that as though it was horrible
at the time. Everything is positive, he says at the time. So it doesn't seem to be only in retrospect. And what I think happened, and this is true of so many filmmakers, everything seems to be going good. He expresses greatest admiration for George Stevens and even Burns and Allen, who might seem not to fit in a Woodhouse movie. And then the movie's released, and it essentially bombs. And I think Woodhouse felt, instead of saying, well, people want to see Fred and Ginger together, not Fred and Joan Fontaine, or even Fred and Burns and Allen.
Yeah.
He seems to have taken that more personally than,
yeah.
than he should have. And there was also a bit of a contretemps with the growing writers' guilds and Philip Dunn, and I think Woodhouse seems to have felt like, why are you accusing me of being anti-union? And so there were some bad feelings. But nonetheless, you know, what's between A Damsel in Distress and Woodhouse wrote this remarkable series of stories of Hollywood, and
yes.
he has this incredible grasp of the studio system, and he develops these studios that he makes up, the Perfecto Zizbaum
yes.
Company, and his Louis B. Mayer is Jacob Schnellenheimer. And so he writes initially his short stories of Hollywood are fairly acidic. But he keeps writing novels towards the very end, and the memories are clearly softer, and he's, well, it's not so bad. The moguls are not so bad. I, you know, write of this fellow getting married so many times. He has nothing left to do when he's out with a woman for a few hours, so he says, would you marry me? So he's writing usually, Woodhouse doesn't write with too much venom, and only in those first few years is it clear that Woodhouse had not been happy in Hollywood, particularly that very first time.
Sure.
When he was just doing bits and pieces of films. And then much later, just almost towards his death, he writes an introduction referring to A Damsel in Distress, and it's like he didn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah.
So no one's ever quite been able to explain it. He was probably just trying to make a good joke out of it, because
yeah.
I'm sure he remembered.
Well, I remember the first time, before I had even read a Woodhouse book, just out of college, I guess I was, when Woodhouse Playhouse started showing mm-hmm. on PBS stations. And I always liked that show until I actually read Woodhouse, and then I could never watch him again.
Mm-hmm.
But Pauline Collins was just so cute. And
mm-hmm.
They would sometimes get close to Woodhouse, but Not really, but the Fry and Laurie series, I think, still remains. Now, I have not seen Blandings, which I guess came out last year. Does that hit the mark?
There's been quite a divergence of opinion. This is the latest series, was at the beginning of this year, 6 episodes of the Blandings Castle story with the Empress of Blandings and her slightly daffy owner.
Empress of Blandings is a
right.
pig.
Yeah. Right. And there was most of the, I'll say, purists were absolutely dismayed. I have to confess, I laughed quite a bit.
Hmm.
But then I think I've come to them with more of an understanding of what challenges the filmmakers
sure.
are facing, as opposed to, you know, thinking, well, why haven't they got all the details? Why is the pig the wrong color? Why is this character short and round instead of tall and thin? And I'm like, well, you get the best actor you can. If you're looking for a pig, there's probably not many pigs in the performing
size, yes,
community.
Oh. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it. I don't know that it, did it actually play here? I don't know that it played.
It hasn't. It,
no.
I caught it on YouTube, mm. and but they have renewed it for a second season. The problem is going to be that there were only 6 Blandings Castle short stories, and apparently the one clunker I thought the thing they had was where they tried to draw various strands from a novel and make a half-hour TV show from it.
Yeah.
So that considering they're running out of original material, that may be that kind of transition may be difficult. Even Jeeves and Wooster, the biggest problem was that they would merge several
sure.
short stories or condense an entire novel, and that part was it's the most difficult. And of course, the biggest tragedy is, you know, in the late 60s, the Ian Carmichael Jeeves and Wooster series. There was a Blandings Castle series with Ralph Richardson,
mm-hmm.
and another. All but one episode completely gone.
Wow. And they just wiped those tapes,
right?
Mm-hmm. And just reused the tapes for other
right.
things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which they were going to do with the Monty Python series, and luckily the Monty Python people found out in time
mm-hmm.
to go rescue them, but just astonishing. They
mm-hmm.
did that with The Tonight Show as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just vast
right.
numbers of episodes gone, just
mm-hmm.
completely gone. So, yeah, we'll never know. We'll never know what those were like. But for a podcast that is about movies, this is the one time I'll say for P.G. Woodhouse, read the books. Then take the films with a grain of salt, because
mm-hmm.
some are okay and some are watchable, but none of them will make you roll on the floor laughing like any random book or short story will. So, I could keep talking to you as you know, but I don't want to torture you, especially when you're getting over a cold. So, thanks, Brian. You know, you were one of the very first people I ever asked to be on this thing, and so it's
well, thank you.
It's taken over 2 years for you to finally get here, but it's been worth it, worth the wait. I really enjoyed our talk, so thanks very much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
That was a whole bunch of fun for me to talk with Brian, and I hope you enjoyed it as well. And it turned out to be a great day. We were down in San Pedro, and so not only did we sit around in his lovely home and talk for a while, and I got to meet his mom, and I got to meet his wife, and it was great fun. And then he and I went to a British pub, and I had a Cornish pasty, and that just about spells heaven to me. So we had another probably 2 hours of talking after this was over, just with no tape rolling. Actually, truth be told, there's no tape rolling when I record these things. It's all on a memory card, but, you know, old cliches die hard. So anyway, we're going to have Brian back one of these days, maybe next year when he comes out to visit his mom again at Christmas time. So look forward to that. And so let me thank everybody, my wonderful wife, Claire McCullough, who's my announcer and my base of support. What would I do without her? I'd have to get a new announcer for one thing. I want to thank Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand. Without them, I'd have to get somebody else to write my theme music. I wouldn't want to do that because they write wonderful stuff. Although, and I'm doing a lot of asterisks today, I think. Although I do have an alternate theme that has already been written by my great friend Michael Bolt. And I just have not decided to make the switch yet, but I think I might make it like the Dick Van Dyke Ottoman and just have the theme song switch off. I wanted to spend a little time letting everybody get used to my musical theme so you could hum along. But the new one is cool too, and I don't know when I'm going to do that, but I will one of these days. And you'll tune in and you'll think you're listening to a different show. But you won't be. You'll be listening to the commentary track. Also, thanks to James Hutchins for designing the websites, thecommentarytrack.com, and my personal website, frankthompson.tv. I talked before Christmas about how my holiday letter would be up on the website, and it sure is. Although it's after Christmas, but you can still go there and read it and be just as puzzled and nonplussed and perplexed as the rest of the reading public. As I may have said to you before, I write my holiday letter with only perplexity in mind. I really only want, I'm not even going for laughs, although I hope that I do get a few laughs in it, but I really am just going for the sheer look of shock on people's face when they read it. So I look forward to the responses that I get every year when these go out. This is the 11th or 12th year, I think, that I've sent them out. And there are the people who like them and who, for reasons known best to them, look forward to them every year. And then there's a huge number of people who simply respond, "Our family's doing fine too. Merry Christmas." Which leads me to believe that they did not read it and just thought that I had sent them a holiday card, such as you get from your dull cousin. But no, I'm your dull podcast host, and it's a different thing altogether. So go to frankthompson.tv, and you can read that. And I'm going to start putting up some other stuff on both websites, a little bit more print content. I just haven't had time to really go into that, but I've got a lot of interviews that I've done over the years, and I think I'm going to pull them out and start posting them on one or both of the websites pretty soon, just so there'll be a little extra reason to go to the website and not just listen to the podcast itself. So look forward to that, won't you? So that wraps up another one. I've got a great one coming up next week, so thanks for listening. And in the meantime, don't you worry, we'll fix it in post.